Melissa Lukashenko is undoubtedly one of this country's finest writers. Her stories are deeply embedded in the Australian landscape, and they're populated by characters that are utterly believable. And I think in fiction, believability in your characters is pretty important. Her fiction is honest, it's raw, it's filled with laconic Australian humour. And in a way, I reckon it tells a national story, her fiction, with a cast of characters like you'd find in the town with one street and a pub and not much else. In Mullumbimby, her previous novel, a native title dispute rocks a small community on the far north coast of New South Wales. And at the same time, it animates the spirits of that place. And there's just the faintest echo of romance. In her latest novel, Too Much Lip, the main character is on one of those trips you take when you have to say goodbye. And the country town at the centre of the novel lives and breathes just like any other character. And I ask Melissa Lukashenko about that fictional place, Dorongo.
Not to be confused with Dorongo near Mullumbimby. Dorongo's a fictional place, and it's a bit inland from where my last book was set. So it's not a real place. If you triangulate Mwillimba and Casino and, I don't know, maybe Bangalore, it's somewhere out west of Lismore, but not very far west. And so it's a dry country, or drier than the coast. It's poorer country than the coast. And it's much more redneck than the area around Mullumbimby where my last book was set. And I did that because I wanted to talk about the lives of black fellas that are really struggling, you know. Not that we don't also struggle in Ocean Shores and Bruns and Mullum, but I'm talking about impoverished communities where the racism's more in your face and where, you know, there's a lot fewer jobs to go around. Poverty and, you know, an active KKK when you get out into the western Bundjalung area, you know, they don't bother to hide the racism when you get right away from the yuppified coast is what I find. It doesn't obviously cost mainstream Australia anything to be incredibly racist towards us, and it benefits them in all sorts of obvious and not so obvious ways. They can't see the damage that is being done to the nation and to their own humanity when they treat us the way they do. And because our numbers are small and because our culture up till now has said don't strike back with violence, don't take up arms unless you're absolutely forced to. You know, the mainstream Australia is reaping the benefit of our civilizations and our peacemaking technologies over thousands of years. They're still reaping the benefit of that and they have no idea. It seems to me that the Aboriginal fallback position is to look for peace, to look for consensus, to look for mediation, a mediated outcome, rather than to do what Palestinians have been forced into doing, for example. You know, which is another completely obvious path to me. I'm not saying I'm a violent person. I'm not. I would always pursue peace where it's possible. But they're benefiting from the fact that we continue to choose peaceful resistance, is what I'm saying.
And do you think that is changing? I mean, I think I also hear in your voice a sense of that doesn't work, or that isn't working right now.
Well, I mean, the alternative hasn't been tested in recent decades, and you know, we live in an era of asymmetric warfare, and we see what that's meant all over the world. Maybe the treaty making process that's being proposed all around the country can help avoid mass violence on our part, because you know, to inflict violence is really to inhabit the savage culture that we were introduced to in 1788, and it's not a path that I would want to go down. I feel in some ways that we're only just holding it together, that we're only just preventing young people from going down that path. Because there's a lot of desperation out there. There's a lot of people with nothing to lose.
Yeah, so
this has gotten all very grim very quickly.
Well, as you said before when we were off air, there are things in the novel. The novel takes its shape from a lot of very hard facts and some difficult circumstances which you fictionalise about, but you've used humour in order to, well, it's not a cover, it's just that we need to have humour as well. And I said to you that I think this is it's a much funnier book than Mullumbimby. There are many more laughs, and like I said, the place name, I'm saying Dorongo, but you know, Drongo,
yeah,
there's all the Drongos. You know, humour has a role in kind of...
It's resistance. Yeah. Humour is resistance. And, you know, I wanted to write a book with a lot of energy because what I see in the community around me is depression and some despair and a few people that are sort of getting on a little bit better from time to time, but lots of being weighed down by circumstances and lots of self-harm, lots of people... in struggle and internalising that struggle, you know, through depression or through family violence or taking it out. And so I wanted to write this high energy woman, the central character, who she's been running all her life, and the book is about what happens when Kerry Salter stops running and faces her demons. And she's got to be forced into a corner to do it. She's got to be forced back to her hometown and pretty much forced to stay there unwillingly so that she's made to face her demons. But when she stops running and she does turn around and say, okay, here I am, and she does what her great-grandmother did in the book. She ran and she ran and she ran, and then she turned around and she stood on her own country, and figuratively she's bleeding when she turns around and she says, okay, let's have it. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die on my own country facing the oppressor.
And there is a beautiful, is it a fictional or is it a real quote at the very start of the novel?
Ah, when you get to the end of the novel, Daniel, you will...
It's a court, it's a court
real.
Transcript? It's real.
It's real, and it's from the court case of my great-grandmother, who was taken away from Bundjalung lands up to the Gympie area, we believe, and... at about 8 years of age, and she never went home. And as a young woman, she was out in the scrub shooting pigeons one day, and there was a fellow who'd been stalking her and harassing her for a while, I gather, and he attempted to rape her in the scrub. And she had her pigeon rifle, and he took it off her, and she picked up a stick to defend herself with, and then he took the stick off her, and so she picked up a rock to defend herself with, and she just kept fighting, and she eventually got the rifle back off him and shot him. She didn't kill him, she wounded him, and then she went to court for attempted murder and stood up in court and said, yes, I did shoot him, I was aiming for his heart, and I'm only sorry I did not kill him.
That's incredible.
It's a great story.
And it's true.
It's true.
Oh,
and
and this is your great-grandmother.
It's my great-grandmother.
I thought I knew a lot about you, but I didn't know that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's not a story that I knew growing up. I only found it out about 5 years ago, the full details. And there's
and
another.
That's where you come from. That's
my blood. I've got her photo open as I'm talking to you now on my phone, to remind me that this book, Too Much Lip, is... I didn't know at the time that I was channeling her spirit so strongly, but, you know, books are funny things. You think you're doing one thing and then you get to the end of the book and it turns out you might have been doing that, but you're doing all sorts of other things as well. And so much of this book actually turned out to be really, really close to my family history, and I didn't know it when I plotted it out in about 2015.
Wow, you know? I was gonna ask, because last time we spoke, Mullumbimby, obviously, around 2013, 2000. And
came out in 2013, yeah.
That was when we spoke. Mm. And we've spoken a lot since then, but not about your work. Mm. And so 5 years, but you plotted it out 3 years ago?
Yeah, books take a long time to gestate. And so some of the elements of this book, the role of the shark, it wasn't it wasn't finally settled, but the image of a shark and what the shark does in this book has been in my head for a hell of a long time. And my mother passed in 2014, and yeah, it really feels like that that shifted things for me, and without really realising it, because I thought the genesis of this book was when I interviewed Alice Walker in 2015, and I read her first novel, which is called The Third Life of Grange Copeland, and which is about three generations of intergenerational trauma in African-American slave family. And I thought, well, if Alice Walker can talk about this stuff, then it's kind of, you know, I'm beholden to talk about the hard stuff too. So I girded my loins and set to writing a story that was not necessarily going to make me many friends, and then realised when I'd finished the book that my great-grandmother was walking beside me all the time. You know, I've had a lot of sleepless nights over this book. It was I constantly questioned myself whether I was doing the right thing, but every time I wavered, she was there telling me to keep going, and also things would happen in daily life that made me think, no, I've got to give voice to this stuff.
On that note, Melissa, could you perhaps maybe read the first few moments of the novel proper?
Sure. Chapter 1. A stranger rode into town, only it wasn't a stranger, it was Kerry, come to say goodbye to Pop before he fell off that perch he'd been clinging to real stubborn way for so long. Cancer, Ken reckoned. Never mind cancer, you couldn't kill the old bastard with an axe. But no good, the call come last night. Get yourself home, chop chop. Kerry dropped into second as she cruised past the corner store, clocking the white normal savages. A dozen blue eyeballs popping fair out of their moogle heads at the sight of her. Skinniest dark girl on a shiny new soft tail, heart attack city, true's god. So yeah, let's go for it, eh, you mob? Let's all have a real good dory at the blackfella du jour. Kerry resisted the urge to elevate both middle fingers as she rode past the astounded locals, past the produce store, past the vacant lot with its waist-high weeds, past the landmark pub which hadn't changed in a century and wasn't about to start now, thanks very much all the same. And when Kerry had made it to the other end of Main Street, that was about it for Dorongo. Place of Centrelink fraud, according to Ken. Population 320. Now, as ever, if you wanted anything more complicated than a beer, a bale of hay or a loaf of last week's bread from Kath at the General Inconvenience Store, you had to make tracks for Paddo half an hour up the highway. As Dorongo petered out, Kerry throttled back. She stopped at the T-junction of Main and Mount Monk Road and straightened first one stiff leg, then the other, letting her toes point skyward in heavy black leather boots. $20,000 of American Heritage Engineering shifted in her hands as she did. Right boot out, a small tilt to the left. Left boot out, a small tilt to the right. Then in a futile gesture towards flying under the gossip radar for at least the afternoon, Kerry turned the bike off. Silence expanded around her. She flipped up her visor and flinched, late December bouncing straight up at her off the tar. 11 in the morning, and already the road soft beneath her boot heels. Sweat broke out on her forehead as she gazed around the empty intersection and the paddocks beyond it. Been a fair while, Kerry murmured to nobody and to everybody. Been a fair old while. She let out a sharp bark of laughter. There was no telling what today might bring or who might be alive at the end of it. Same as any other f***ing day in Dorongo, in other words. Only more so.
You know, Dorongo is a character, and you know, sometimes in your books, the places live and breathe just like, I don't want to say it, they're like characters, and I think that's an overused kind of cliche, but you know, those places are inhabited and they're real to me.
Oh, thanks for saying so. I'm glad it works. I mean, I put a lot of work into this book, hey. It was to solid years of hard yakka, hard yakka. And I started drinking again in the course of writing the book, which is something I've got to address. But we'll have the launch next week. And
after that?
After that, yes. Definitely after that.
I remember, as I say, Mullumbimby, one of my favourite novels, one of my favourite Australian novels. But I always thought that the way that you create your stories is that they're, for me, they're intensely visual.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's because, you know, we breathe the same air in terms of a country and that we inhabit the same places in our minds.
Mm.
But the, you know, this, the pictures I get, I think you do spend a lot of time thinking about how people are visualising what you write.
I have a very visual brain, Daniel, and I was reading about Kerry Hume, the Maori author, last night, and what was she saying? That she dreams very vivid and exciting and dramatic dreams, and I do too. I have terribly violent dreams a lot of the time, but they're not nightmares and they're not necessarily disturbing. There's just a lot of violence in them, but also all this weird stuff and really incredible things happen, and it's highly visual. And I think that's true for my waking life as well. When I sit down to write, I can see it. It's like it unspools, like a film reel, old-fashioned film reel unspooling. And this was a tricky book to write because I didn't know exactly what was going to, I didn't know how the book was going to end until I was about three quarters of the way through. I knew there had to be a shark doing the things that the shark does, and I certainly visualised the place really, really strongly. The River Bend is based on a real river bend at New Brighton that has some great spiritual importance to me, because a dear sister of mine, I associate it with her, and she's gone now, and her funeral was at that river bend. Mm. And yeah, I knew I had these various images. The people were very clear in my mind. The voices were clear in my mind. And the tone of the book was very clear right from the start, but I didn't know where it was going to end up. So I guess I was just jumping from image to image in lots of ways.
And, you know, people talk about the authentic voice. And if there's one thing I can say about your characters, they're utterly believable. And I think I always say her characters are utterly believable, because to me, in your fiction, believability is kind of a critical thing. And in all fiction, you want to, if it's about the here and now, it's not science fiction, it's not the imaginary, you have to be able to picture people saying this. And when you're talking about us, when you're talking about Aboriginal people, I think it's important that those characters are real, that they're actualised.
Yeah, and I don't want there to be any barrier between my voice as an author and my Aboriginal audience, and I just want the story to be able to flow. And if I've got characters who aren't, you know, who aren't real, who aren't authentic in any way, that's going to interrupt that. And plus, we deserve to be in these pages. You know, we deserve to have our voices heard. We deserve to be people of note. We deserve to be the main characters in these stories and in lots of stories. So, yeah, I do strive to get the voices right, get the people right. But again, that's not a difficult thing for me. The difficult thing for me is to, A, keep it funny and keep the energy level right up there, keep it cranking along. At one point there was going to be a sex scene on a motorbike, but that's one of the things that went by the wayside in the book. But it's keeping it funny, and it's not losing sight of what I was trying to do in the book, which was talk about ways out of trauma. You know, I wanted originally to have five siblings who'd come from a very violent family and who had all gone in different directions. It turned out that I could only manage four. It was already complicated enough with four. Five was not manageable. So I've got four siblings, and they've responded to their upbringing in four really different ways.
The award-winning writer Melissa Lukashenko and her latest novel, Too Much Lip, is published by UQP. This is Away on RN.